that brings us to the next presentation, which triggered a lot of my interest when I saw the slides as well, which is by Arnoud Engelfried from Philips, at least I can pronounce the name, and which shows us that it's not so black and white, it's not open source or closed source, there are ways to live with mixtures of it, and we're quite interested to hear about it. Arnoud, please.
Thank you, Mark. To introduce myself, I'm a European patent attorney at the IP department of Philips. For the past 3 or 4 years, we have been working with open source, studying how to handle open source. Also, suddenly the complete CII directive and all that came up, so you triggered some nasty flashbacks. I hope I can sleep tonight. Anyway, I'm going to talk about how we in Philips use open source, what we did to get the rules right and to get everybody in the same line. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about how you can make an effective choice. What do you want to open source, when do you want to use open source, and when do you not want to open source something. People usually here keep questions to the end, but if anything isn't clear, or if I talk too fast, just let me know. So, we already heard quite a few terms like GPL, BSD, viral license, contamination, things like that. Since I have to work with the open source community, and they tend to get very upset, including frothing at the mouth and physical violence, if you use the word viral, I use different terms. So, the first kind of open source that we have is what I call free-for-all, which is licenses like the BSD license, that basically said, give us credit. But in effect, you can put it in your own product, and the whole stuff can be your own license, if you want. You only have to credit the origin. The second type is what we call keep open, so you have to keep that open, but you can combine it with your own larger works as much as you want. But if you modify the open source parts, you have to make them open source as well. So that's why I have this little animation.
Excuse me, that would be what, the LGPL?
LGPL, Mozilla license would be examples here. And the third one, which I call share alike, because that's a better word than viral, I think, more positive at least. But you have to share not only your modifications, but also extensions, parts of your own code.
This only happens if you redistribute. Nothing prevents you from taking something which is GPL, do something internally, do whatever you want with it and not redistribute it.
You're absolutely correct. Philips is a company that basically sells products, so...
you don't control that are doing air traffic management systems that are not sold to the general public, typically. Yeah. That's perfectly acceptable.
That's excellent point. If you are going to use it internally in your organization, that's fine. I'm approaching this from the point of view of a distributor. So whatever we do, it's going to be distributed, so for me this is a given. But you're right, only if you distribute does this apply. If you use it internally, you don't have to tell anybody, you don't have to share anything.
Even Philips could use a modified version within its own production line for its own purposes.
Yes,
we could.
What's internally, what's an organization in this sense? Mm-hmm.
That's a very good question, especially if you're multinational with over 5,000 BVs and limiteds and etc.
That's a very good question. The interesting point here, the reason why people don't like the term viral, is that if you, Philips, took Microsoft Windows, including to your product, viral, not viral, you couldn't do that, full stop.
Correct.
And so that's why the term viral has been sneaked in, and it's saying, I really like the way you present things. Yeah. Share alike, because it's more constructive than tainted terms.
Yeah. We also know who came up originally with the term viral. You already suggested that probably. So that's another reason not to use the word. Anyway, with this in mind, for product development, you have to keep in mind, if I'm going to use something and it's free for all, I don't care as IP department, as open source clearance board, go ahead. If a product manager comes to me and says, hey, I've got this great piece of open source, and you find out it's share alike, and some alarm bells will go off, because we have to be much more careful what the impact is going to be on our own source code if we comply with such a license. What does it mean? And so that's why I teach this. I don't teach technical people the specific licenses. They don't want to know, and they shouldn't have to know. That's my job. So they should know basically the consequences, and then we can discuss the impact. So in Philips, like I already said, we use open source in products, mainly consumer electronics. So if you've got some examples like our hard disk DVD recorder over there, some universal remote controls and web tablets that we have. We've got a new line of what we call Connected Planet, which are wirelessly connected devices. Most of them stealthily run Linux with 802.11 to communicate and to stream all the video to each other. We've also got chips, like the Nexperia line of chips, where we've got the compiler, toolchains, Linux ports, and all that available. We also have other products where we use open source here and there, but it's the most prolific in these areas. Main reasons for that are initially cost reduction and faster time to market. You don't have to buy it from somebody, you can get it for free, but we're also now looking at making it more systematic, getting more benefits and releasing our own software as open source. That's a great thing, but if you want to do that, you first need to get some ground rules, which is why we as Philips established the open source policy. Because we said, okay, our products can benefit from open source, our research and development also, but that's less important, because like you said, there's no consequences. Our products may benefit from open source, our suppliers are using open source more and more, our customers, especially in the professional market, are using open source more and more. So that's great, let's do it, but it can have impact for our IPR. For example, we have patents, we have many patents, and we don't want to license them for free without checking what's going on first. If you use open source, there is that obligation, so we want to be very careful with that. There's also the possibility that we have to make Philips source code available as open source, especially if we use share alike open source. So we want to make sure that we know what we're doing and when we're doing that. And that shouldn't be the choice of the individual engineer who said, hey, let's link this together. It should be a decision in the product design process.
Excuse me, IPR is
intellectual property rights.
Rights.
Patents, copyrights in this case.
Arnold, yeah. Is it considered distribution if you sell, say, a VCR with embedded software,
yeah,
which is, say, free software or GPL or otherwise? Is it considered distribution?
Yeah, I would most definitely.
Because
yeah.
One question that was asked was, I put some GPL software onto a missile that I used to shoot at Iraq.
Yeah.
And the question that was asked to Stallman is this considered a distribution?
Yeah.
And the answer was, well, of course not.
Yeah, but that's because you don't actually give the missile to anybody. But if you are an arms dealer and you sold it to Saddam Hussein or whoever is sitting there, then it is.
Yeah, I mean, if you have to give the missile manufacturer has sold it to the DoD, that's presumably distribution.
Yeah. So the DoD has the right to demand source code for the missile, for example. Because the missile
we have it anyway.
As a taxpayer, can we
you can keep the missile with the source code. I mean, you can put the source code into the missile.
Okay.
Yeah, talk about deliverables.
So let's make
Well, but put the same play for the VCR. It says, the source code inside the VCR, just go and get the, it's in the ROM.
Well, of course, it has to be accessible to the outside world. We've got products with a hard disk, and we put the source code of Linux and the related components on that hard disk. And if you read very carefully to the documentation, and nobody does that, but if you do that, you will see, hey, this uses Linux. And it's there on the hard disk. For most people, this will be, why do I have 20 megabytes on my hard disk? Because I want to record TV programs, so they will delete it. That's fine, but if you, I was going to say if you're a nerd, but if you're interested in the source code, you can access it.
Well, that's the way you do it, that's interesting.
If you have a hard disk, you can do that. In other products, we have a CD-ROM with documentation. Well, the documentation is 30 megabytes, CD-ROM is 600 megabytes, so let's just put the source code on that. A few people are going to bother, and that's a practical frustration for our product managers. They say, nobody wants this source code. And I say, yeah, but you have to. And they're like, that's
stupid. You can put it on the website.
You can't, actually. Yeah. The license says either you ship it with the product, or you make a written offer to give it to anybody who writes to you.
Yeah. You
or if you put it on a website yourself, then you can put the source code on the website yourself. If you put the binary in a product, the source code has to accompany the product. That's GPL3B says accompany it with the complete source code.
GPL3, you're talking, that doesn't exist yet.
GPL clause 3, section B. That's what GPL version 2, article 3, section B.
You talk to the folks at the FSF.
Yeah.
I did, and that's what they said. And if you read their FAQ, they will say you can do this. If you put it on a website, you can put the source on the website. If you ship the code to somebody, you have to ship the source code or include a written offer. This will hopefully be fixed in GPL version 3.
No. I think we should continue with this policy on open source.
Okay. So anyway, our policy as we formulate it. First of all, internal use is unrestricted, addressing your point. Go ahead, I don't care, as long as you put a big sticker on it that says internal use only. Because what tends to happen is research makes a great prototype, and then the business manager says, this is a great prototype, I'm going to turn this into a product. And then suddenly that internal use that links with whatever and contains stolen code from wherever goes into a product. We can't have that. So you can give research the rule like internal use is fine, but keep in mind it's going to end up elsewhere than where you want it. So be careful with that. To use it in a product is also fine, as long as it does not apply to what we call differentiating technology. I'm going to get to that in a minute. So that's not stuff that's going to distinguish our product from the competition. And it doesn't force us to open valuable patents, for example. So we want to be careful with that and use open source only where it makes sense for us. And also, if we release something as open source, it has to benefit the community. There's no point in starting a complete competitor to an existing open source project. We should rather move to that open source project ourselves. And to make this work in practice, people should involve IPNS, our department, the IP department, and what we call the Open Source Advisory Board. Other companies call it the Open Source Clearance Board, Open Source Review Board. I have another sheet on that, so I'll get to that in a minute. Now, if you are considering working with open source, keep in mind you're going to need an open source policy. Because whether you know it or not, your engineers are using open source at this very moment. And your suppliers are giving you open source. And your customers are linking your code with open source. And if you're lucky, they will tell you. But I can no longer count the number of times I've been on the phone with a supplier, and then one of our engineers is just snooping around and says, hey, there's this file called gpl.txt and on this CD-ROM that we get from the supplier. So I ask the supplier, hey, is it true? Is your software GPL? And the lawyer says, what's GPL? And then I explain him, and then he says, we will have to get back to you. And then for 3 weeks I hear nothing, and then something happens. So I sometimes give this talk, and then people say, not in my company. And that's where I use this picture. Please be very careful. Today, if you hire a software engineer, he probably has a spare time project in open source. He's working on open source, using open source, so be very careful with that. It's not to say that that's a bad thing, but you have to keep that in mind. That is simply a fact of life. That's what people are doing. So be prepared for that, and be prepared to deal with that. And if you try to outlaw it, well, you're as smart as this might be. So the next question for you is to decide, how do you benefit from open source? What's the point for us? And there's two general ways that you can use, consumption or participation. You can be a user of open source and say, okay, some stuff we're going to make ourselves, some stuff we're going to buy from a third party, and some stuff we're going to get from open source. Or we're going to buy open source from a third party because then we get support. That's fine with me. That's passive. So then you just say, we need an operating system. Okay, we've got a list, Linux is an option, let's see if it works. A more proactive way is to participate in open source, where you say, okay, we've got this project, like Apache, the web server, but it doesn't work for our embedded products. So let's patch it so that it does, contribute those patches so that we don't have to maintain it anymore, and then we adapt this existing product. Or you can have your own code and start your own project in open source to create community around that product, to contribute that project to the open source community. And that's of course a lot more powerful because you can share costs and you can share contributions, but it requires a lot more discipline. Because you no longer just take other people's code and use it in a product, but now you've got your own code base that's 10 years old and nobody knows who wrote what anymore, and where that came from, and where that came from. And you're putting that for the world to see, including all the foul comments and the stupid things and the revelations about your products that you don't want anybody to see. So this is tricky. It can be powerful, but it can also be very tricky. And like I said, you're going to need a review board. Because a policy is a great thing to have, but then you need everybody to comply with it. And you need somewhere that people can turn to say, okay, what do I do? Is this allowed? Is this not allowed? So set up a group that's able to represent all your business units, or in our case, product divisions, and preferably also involve the legal and the IP departments, so that you have everybody on board who has expertise in this area. And you may want to liaison with purchasing, customer services, communications, and HR. For example, I get a few calls from HR departments every year where they say, yeah, we've got this guy, we want to hire him as a software engineer, but in his spare time he says he is working on something called open source, which I don't really understand, and then I have to explain to him what he's doing. And then maybe you have to review their labor contracts. Because if the labor contract says everything you write is owned by Philips, then he's got a problem with his open source project, because he can't do that anymore. So you need to be careful with clauses like that. The same for customer services. If people call customer services and they say, there's this 20 megabyte thing called linux.tar.gz on my hard disk, customer services needs to have an answer to that. So you need to get that into their flowchart. Otherwise, they cannot answer the call. And all those things you encounter when you start doing this. When people get a CD-ROM with source code and they put it in their CD player, it doesn't play, and they will complain to customer services. Customer services need to have a flowchart for that. So those are all things that you need to take into account when you do this. For suppliers and customers, also very important. Like I said, they will ship you open source, and if you're lucky, they will tell you. And your customers are going to do all kinds of nasty stuff with the software you give them. So what we recommend and what we did is create contract clauses that address this in the way that you want it. We, by default, say, we don't want open source from you, dear supplier. And we tell our customers, you are not allowed to open source or to combine our software with open source in any way. Now, suppliers typically scream because, you can't do that, it is way too restrictive. And if you probe a little, then you suddenly discover there was open source in there. But if I talk to other customers of that supplier, those other customers were never told that. So a clause like this may seem draconian, may seem much too restrictive, but it tends to prod people because then they really pay attention. Because this is where their lawyer asks their people, are you sure? We have to sign this. And we have to assume a liability to Philips. So are you sure? And then one engineer said, well, we've got this little piece of software which is called Linux. And then the lawyer comes back and says, how can you do that? And this is completely unreasonable, and are you out of your mind? And then we've got a discussion. Otherwise, nobody would have noticed, and then 3 years from now, we had to do a product recall because we're violating the GPL. So that's a big issue. And I see this with more and more companies that start to insert these kind of clauses. Getting it right is, of course, the big trick. But I'm sure in a few years this will be standard clause.
What's your last clause? I can't read it.
Don't make our software open source, basically. And that's just, if we license you to make derivative works, we're going to say your license to make derivative works does not include a license to make a derivative work based on GPL software as well. So you cannot link it with GPL software, because we don't want you to open source this. And if they say that they have to, okay, great. Then we can talk and we can make a different clause.
And that's for your subcontractors.
So like for semiconductors, where we give some reference code or some library and they want to combine it. So end users typically won't get this clause because they don't get source code, except for the parts that are already open source. Okay, another thing to keep in mind is when you look at open source, it's great, but you have to keep in mind there's going to be some issues. Like, you need to know which parts can we distribute only as open source. So what are the license implications? And suppliers will typically tell you, don't worry about anything. But you may have to, even if you use only what I call free-for-all open source, BSD software. Many suppliers tell me, just go ahead, there's no GPL, do whatever you want. And then the supplier later tells me there is lots of BSD code in there, which means we had to reprint the documentation to put all those notices in there. And that's a big issue in some cases. So what I do is I put in the contract a clause that says, you must give me all the necessary information. And then also, you're going to need to think about the question, how will you distribute source code to your customers? Because that could be a big issue when you're going to take the top during the break, I guess. But in our reading, you have to give that to all your customers. So is your customer service department going to make that available? You're going to have a stack of CD-ROMs. You have a website, and the website is redesigned every 6 months. So how do you keep that link intact? So those are big issues. That was the part about what we do in Philips. I've also got a talk, which is more than the 5 minutes I have, which is about how to know what you want to make open source and what not. And for that, I always tell people, look at the box of your product. Because from the box, you can tell which features you can open source and which you cannot. The things that are on the box in big blue letters, in our case, are the things that people want to buy your product for. So people are in the store and they say, hey, this one has 40 gigabytes. I want that. It has an FM radio. Great. I want that. if you look on the side of the box, there's things like batteries not included, or has headphones, or has a shuffle play, supports MP3. Those are the features that you're looking for, because you won't buy them if they are not there. If it does not support MP3, you will not buy it. But if it does support MP3, you say, okay, now let's look at the front again. And the third kind of feature I cannot show you, because nobody cares about it, so you don't put it on the box. For example, runs Linux. You can tell that from the box. I don't even know if this product runs Linux, but that's the third kind of feature. And that's, in fact, where I have this classification. So the differentiator are the stuff you can put on the box. The baseline is what you put on the side of the box. And the commodity features are the stuff that you don't put anywhere on the box. And if you can make this classification, then it's already easy to decide which ones do I want to open source and which don't I want to open source. And it's actually very easy. The differentiators, you don't want to open source. The commodities, you want to open source. And the baseline software is a case-by-case decision. And that's where you need people like me to make that decision, so this keeps me. But I always try to make this clearer, but this is a struggle, because if you have a library and you say, okay, we could make, this is an MP3 library, okay, we could make it open source, but there's a benefit and there's a risk, and how do you balance that? So that's just a lot of work, because it's very fact specific. And I haven't found yet anyone who can give me a good argument other than everything should be open source, but that's not an option for us at least. One of the practical projects that we have is called ABIS. I forgot what it stands for, but I think it's Active Block I/O Scheduling System, which is a hard disk extension to the Linux hard disk system, where you can do real-time access to a hard disk, getting video streams out of there. So if you want to play different streams, you can add through ABIS, I want this stream at this many kilobytes per second, and it will either tell you, yes, you will get that, or it will tell you, I'm sorry, you're already full. And with that information, you can make a hard disk recorder or an audio player in a much better way. And this project, this was the first project where we systematically decided this should be open, this should not be open, this is where we need this license, there we need this license. I'm looking at Mark again. This is going to take some time.
Carry on.
You want to carry on?
This is fun.
Okay.
It's eating into the coffee breaks when people accept it.
Coffee break has not started yet.
Okay, so very briefly, I will not try not to get too much into the technical details, but you've got a Linux kernel, which creates the interface between things like the hard disk and other hardware. And you've got this application, let's say it's a video streaming application. So you want to get video from that hard disk onto a display screen. And in a consumer electronics project, it has to be guaranteed throughput rate. You can't have hiccups. And I know in PC software people think differently, but if you have a TV, you don't want it to hiccup. So enter ABIS, where we say, okay, we've got this extension to the Linux kernel, and we've got a little library that you can use to interface with that kernel extension. And if your application wants to get real-time access, it will use the library to access that kernel extension, and then say, I want this at 20 kilobytes per second, or something like that. And then the BIS will say, yeah, I can do that, or no, you can't have it. Sounds great. If you look inside this ABIS, we've got a scheduling algorithm, which tries to balance all those balls. We've got a policy setting, which tells you what kind of balls are acceptable, and how many you can juggle at the same time, and how fast you can juggle. We've got an application interface, to make sure applications can use all this. And we've got some patches to make it work with the Linux kernel. So looking into the category that we had earlier, we've got differentiating features. We've got must-have features, baseline features. You have to have an interface. And nobody cares about it, but you need changes to make it work with Linux. So there we did that classification, which is great. Except for one thing, the Linux kernel is GPL. So if you're going to do a Linux kernel extension, your whole extension is going to be GPL. It's the only way to distribute it. And we're going to put this in the product, so we would have to give away the scheduling algorithm and the policy setting stuff. And that really is differentiating for us, because with that knowledge, we make our products better than the competition. So back to the drawing board, the legal drawing board in this case. When talking to the engineers, they said, yeah, actually, that scheduler is really a separate piece of software. I just put it in the Linux kernel because that seemed the best way, but we can separate it out. A separate kernel module, for those who are familiar with that. So you can have a separate scheduler. You still have your kernel patches that make the scheduler work with Linux, and that make the functions available to the library. And I said, okay, what do you do with that policy? Well, he said, actually, now that I think about it, it's better to put that in user space. To not put it in the kernel, but make it a separate program where you can plug in different policies depending on your application. So we've got one policy, which is Philips, and the second policy, which is just a stupid default policy that anyone can think of. No more than three balls at the same time. Fine. And with this picture, we can do the analysis again. So the stars, the checkboxes, and the black boxes. We know immediately the scheduler and this policy thing, that's core, that's differentiating, that's our knowledge. We don't want to open source that. This kernel patch here is now very trivial because we basically removed everything that was interesting. So what we have left, I don't care about it. It can be GPL, no problem. And we have this library, and this daemon must have checkbox feature. If you don't have this library, nobody will use it, but the fact that you have the library doesn't mean anything. And now it's becoming a lot more easy to say which parts do we want to open source. We don't want to open source the scheduler. We don't want to implement open source the part that implements our policy. We don't care if the kernel part is open source, so if we have to, fine. And for the libraries and the daemon, we have to decide. For the library, why not? There's no real core knowledge in that. We can make it LGPL so that everybody can link it, but if people change the interface, they're going to want to change the library, and they will have to share those changes. So in this case, LGPL is a good choice. For the daemon, similarly, you can keep it proprietary, and then everybody can only use our daemon, but why should you? Let's make this one LGPL as well. Then we can have the proprietary policies, but the daemon itself is available and can be changed and updated. And this is the way that the project was made available. So you do an analysis, and you actually have to change the technical architecture if you find out that your technical choices influence your legal options. So it's an interaction between the designers and the legal people to make sure that you get this. So you're going to need people that understand both technology and law. And I know they are hard to find, but probably you'll find out easily enough when your lawyers are interested in technology and can understand technology. If you have somebody like that, great, get them to do this kind of stuff because it can be very beneficial to your organization. In conclusion, open source can be great, but there also can be risks. If you want to manage those risks, make sure you've got people who understand the licensing in both legal and technical aspects. Implement a policy that suits your organization and set up an advisory board, review board, clearance board, whatever board you want to call it. And to benefit from open source, make sure that you can place those signs and make an analysis like this so that you know this can be open source, this cannot be open source. Here it's a toss-up and here we have to talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Arnold.
Thank you. I'm sure there are questions.
I have Martin, a question about consumption versus production. So for example, you have that VCR which runs Linux.
Yes.
And you obviously had to make some changes to Linux to run on that. And then because of the GPL, you have to make those changes available. But now there's a difference to whether you just make those changes available on the CD or on the website, or whether you actively try to integrate those changes with the Linux kernel. And is there anything in your policy which addresses that?
Our policy actually says that if the project itself would benefit from giving back changes, then we should try to give back those changes. In some cases, the changes would be specific to our one particular product, then it makes no sense.
Right. And do you take the long term into effect as well, for example? I can take an example. There are all those wireless access points which use a MIPS CPU,
and
so they need some changes to the Linux kernel. And those changes are available, but they are horrible.
Yes.
They're basically a Windows port to Linux, so they will never be accepted by the Linux developers.
Yeah.
And no one of those companies are working with the Linux people to integrate them. So that's fine because they have a product, but in 2 years the Linux kernel is going to advance, and if they want to have a new product, they have to do all their work again. But if they had integrated it, it would be there.
The problem that you have there is a conflict of interest between getting this product out of the factory now and doing something that is a long-term benefit for the company and
but
the community as a whole.
How do you cope with that?
With great difficulty. In fact, we have set up some long-term projects, one of which is called the CE Linux Forum. where we, together with other CE companies, consumer electronics companies, work together on improving Linux to work better in the area of consumer electronics, like faster boot up time, booting from a ROM, Abyss, and projects like that, where we share cost and development to create a common kernel. And those kind of things we want to give back, but it's going to get a few megabytes of patch, which is going to be difficult to explain to Linus, but that's at least what we're doing.
How does it work? Oh, this cooperative. This is a co-op, basically. How does it work?
It works pretty well, although we have to work with Japanese companies, and that's, for cultural reasons, somewhat difficult at times. And the most difficult part for most companies is to move from the proprietary model to the open source model, where they have to realize, I give this code to Philips and to my older competitors, and what do I get in return? Yeah, some goodwill. And that people have to get around to the fact that Philips will later contribute something else as well.
So the developers are part of their respective companies, and
correct,
then they contribute to...
So what we did there was set up a forum and a foundation, actually, where you would say, okay, we have these members and the steering board, and there's rules like it has to be GPL. When you contribute it, you have to warrant that you own the copyright, or at least have the right to GPL this software. You have to warrant that you don't have any patents on what you are contributing, etc., etc., so that all the legal ground rules are set within the foundation. The thing we are lacking a bit is support from the open source community as a whole, but that's because it's a very specialist niche, and it's kind of hard to get these PC guys to suddenly work on a little chip where we say, I'm sorry, we only have 16 megabytes, that's it. And by the way, you cannot update it too often because it's flash and it will wear out. They will say, that's stupid, I will just go back and buy 2 gigabytes of RAM. And that's the culture class, where you have CE versus PC, and that's always a difficult match. Any other questions? I'm going to take the GPL issue offline, because if I'm wrong, it would save a lot, but I would...
Okay, let's take it offline, let's have a coffee, and be back by 4 o'clock.